something amiss has happened. I would put it this way.
Let me ask you the reverse of that then. If this is claim preclusion, if the bank were to have prevailed, and let's say there is a period of redemption, and the homeowner finds a way to work that out with the bank, but then the homeowner's in default later, would that be claim preclusion against the homeowner too?
If the
because it was decided once, the homeowner lost.
And the bank won. And if the property is redeemed, that means the bank has been either it means the mortgage has been satisfied. If the parties decided to move in a different direction, settle the matter, and reinstate the note, the parties can certainly agree as a matter of freedom of contract to reinstate that note. That would create new obligations which would then be enforceable subsequently.
Counsel, about the acceleration, your position, if I understand it correctly, is that the bank lost out on proving it was a holder of the note. Is that correct?
Can you please repeat the question?
Sure. My understanding of your position is that the bank failed to prove that it was a holder of the note. Yes?
Correct. The bank, and more precisely, the bank failed to prove that it was entitled to enforce the note.
All right. Now, prior to the lawsuit, it purportedly accelerated the note, correct?
I'm sorry, I have to ask you to repeat the question.
Prior to the lawsuit, the bank, at least purportedly, accelerated the note.
Correct.
Yes? Okay.
That certainly was what was claimed.
Okay, did it?
It claimed that it accelerated
the
note. Yes,
but I'm asking you, did it?
The court in the first action found that notice of acceleration was not provided. So presumably here, looking at the decision, the note would have been accelerated, but notice of acceleration was not provided.
So was it effectively accelerated?
I believe that in the first action, the note was not effectively accelerated.
All right. So to whom is Mr. Thompson making payments on the note currently?
He's not making payments to anyone on the note.
Why is that?
Because he believes that the second action should not have been brought, that he has no further obligation under the note, given the first judgment.
Okay. First judgment depends on the note having been accelerated, your position, at least. So if the note has not been accelerated, regardless of the results of the first action, why is he not making payments on the note right now?
Well, in the first action, the plaintiff failed to establish that it was even entitled to enforce the note. So who is Mr. Thompson supposed to pay? Furthermore,
So let me just help you out with that. He's supposed to pay the person he borrowed the money from, right?
He also...
Right? Is that correct?
That's how a promissory note works,
okay.
Yes.
Now proceed.
Yes, but if there's a judgment, as in this case, and a subsequent action is precluded,
let me just stop you there again. The judgment did not excuse him from making payments on the loan, correct?
The first judgment most certainly did.
The first judgment said the bank could not enforce it in that proceeding, right?
Correct.
There's still a note. Yes?
There is a note, yes.
There is a note, okay. And it's not been accelerated, yes?
I'm sorry?
And it's not been accelerated.
I can't say. There's nothing in the record that would indicate that it has been accelerated.
Okay. And you don't have a ruling that the note is invalid, correct?
The note is out there. I see your point, Justice Kelly. The note is out there, but it's unclear who, if anyone, can enforce it.
Okay. And what is Mr. Thompson doing to figure out who he should be paying his payments to?
Presumably, in this case, there's only been one party, really several parties that are privies that have sought to enforce the note, and they have not, as demonstrated, as established in the first action, BAC, Home Loan Servicing, and its subsequent interest holders in the note do not have the right to enforce it.
Okay. So Justice Ziegler was asking you just a moment ago about a free house. And you, part of your response was to say that that's a loaded question, that it, in, it includes certain moral questions, including whether he has an obligation to pay what he borrowed. Does he have a moral obligation to pay what he borrowed?
I think that's up to Mr. Thompson. We talk about legal obligations.
Does he have a contractual obligation to pay what he borrowed?
There is a contractual obligation to pay under the note. I want to make this point, though. Mr. Thompson came to court and defended his position. He insisted on the case against him be proven. He came to court and was ready to pay the price of any judgment that was granted by the circuit court. He was prepared to pay the price. And our point here is that a plaintiff that fails to prove its case must similarly be prepared to pay the price.
All right. So if the position is, as you have stated this morning, that there's nothing in the record to suggest that the note has been accelerated, then Mr. Thompson would be liable for failing to make payments after the judgment of the first trial, correct?
That seems to make sense. The question here is, who has the right to enforce that note? And as I said, presumably the party that claimed the right to enforce the note was unable to establish its case.
Okay, so now we have a new party. We have Fannie Mae. Fannie Mae says it has the note, right? And Fannie Mae says, Mr. Thompson, you failed to make payments subsequent to the judgment in the first trial. That constitutes a new default, and therefore now you're liable for those defaults, correct?
I don't agree with that statement.
Okay. What part of that was incorrect?
All of the payments that were due under the note were litigated in the first action. That's part of the transaction that was litigated. Is there any question that the plaintiff in the first action, BAC, would have sought, had it prevailed, a judgment on the entirety of the note?
I don't know, Mr.
Of course it would.
I don't know, Mr. Strobel, because you told me just this morning that the note has not been accelerated. If the note has not been accelerated, then the bank was only entitled to collect on the specific payments that had not been made at that point.
The plaintiff in the first action did not successfully prove its claim, but claim preclusion attaches to the claim brought. Were we supposed to second guess, oh, and say a particular claimant did not prove their claim, so we rewind the clock and allow that claimant a second chance?
Yeah.
No.
So let me try this. How many payments had been missed at the time of the first trial?
I'm not sure, Your Honor.
A year's worth?
I can't say for sure.
Okay.
I don't know.
Let's speculate for the purposes of a hypothetical, and let's say it's about a year's worth of payments. So perhaps what occurred in the first trial is that claim preclusion attaches to those payments because your position is the note was not accelerated. And if it's not accelerated, the only thing at issue with that trial would have been the payments that had been missed as of the date of the judgment, correct?
No, the claim in that trial was to enforce the note in its entirety. The fact that that right was not proved is just one more failure of the plaintiff in that case to establish its claim.
And if
Res judicata that we used to call res judicata, right? Claim preclusion.
Yes.
Okay. And the concept is on res judicata that everything that was brought up at the trial and could have been brought up at the trial relating to this transactional approach is finished. You can't cut up your claim into little pieces and continue to bring lawsuits on each little piece. You have to bring it all together or it is gone. I mean, that's the theory of claim preclusion and res judicata, is it not?
Yes, and the finality of the circuit court's decision must be respected. We can't have piecemeal litigation later trying to slice and dice or chop up what should have been litigated in the first action into smaller pieces, and that's exactly what Fannie Mae is trying to do here by limiting the area of default or claiming that there's a new default.
Well, the problem, the thing that sticks in your throat when you talk about this case is that the first dismissal with prejudice, right?
Yes.
was not what I would call on the merits of the case.
I believe the first dismissal was necessarily on the merits of the case.
Okay. What were the grounds for the first dismissal?
According to the court's decision,
yes.
Fannie Mae failed to prove a right to a notice of acceleration, failed to have evidence of default admitted. So that wasn't proved. And as the Court of Appeals recognized, Fannie Mae's predecessor, BAC, also failed as part of its action to establish entitlement to enforce the note at all.
All right. Why? Why did it fail to have a claim on the note?
Well, the predecessor in interest failed to meet the requirements under 403.308.
This is the original note, this is what the amount is owed, et cetera.
Right.
So that's why it was dismissed, right?
Correct.
And all claims on that note could have been brought in that first case, right?
Of course, and that's what the plaintiff was seeking to do. Everybody understood that. Mr. Thompson understood that his home was being foreclosed on and would be sold if the plaintiff were successful to satisfy not just a few payments under that note, but every payment that would ever be due under that note.
Counsel, is there another document besides the order dismissing the foreclosure complaint with prejudice? It's dated September 11, 2012. Because that document doesn't have any of the things you're talking about. All it says is the court finds that the plaintiff did not have sufficient evidence and or witnesses to proceed and dismisses the case with prejudice. That's all it says.
Yeah, and we can turn to the Court of Appeals decision and see that as a part of that failure, the Court of Appeals looked at the record and said there is nothing in the record to show that the plaintiff ever established the entitlement.
Well, what I read the Court of Appeals as saying is that the circuit court goofed up when it said with prejudice because it mixed up the standards for criminal and civil law, but because that wasn't argued to the circuit court, the bank waived that argument. That's how I read the Court of Appeals.
Well, the Court of Appeals in paragraph 24 of the decision addressed this issue, addressed whether entitlement to enforce the note had been proved and recognized that it could not have been proved, that there was nothing in the record to prove that.
Well, that's what the circuit court said. There was not enough evidence or witnesses to proceed.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
But that's the final circuit court order. There's no judgment that goes after the order dismissing. Is that correct? I'm asking you because I think the record here is less than complete.
There is no other order following that dismissal.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, I want to back up and put this in a framework. I understand that both parties agree that there are three elements to claim preclusion. Is that your understanding? There's an agreement to that basic premise.
Yes.
Is it your understanding that you and your opposing counsel agree that the first element, identity of parties, and the third element, dealing with the court action and judgment, are not at issue here?
Correct.
Is that your understanding of both your position and your opposing counsel's position?
Based on the briefings, yes.
Based on the briefings, that's right. And then that obviously leads to the conclusion that the issue for us, based on the briefings, is whether or not there's an identity of claim, which is the second element of claim preclusion. Is that your understanding?
That's the issue.
Okay. Please tell me how there is an identity of claim for payments that did not exist, missed payments that did not yet come into a reality in the first order that was issued, that is the order of dismissal
based on insufficient evidence. Is my question clear?
I believe
so. I'll rephrase it.
Based on payments that weren't due.
That weren't yet due.
That's a good question.
That's
what I was...
That's exactly. So why is there identity of claim based on payments that were not yet due?
Right, the future installment payments. If the loan, if the claim is for the loan as accelerated, and that was the claim that was made in the first action for the accelerated loan, and that would include not only any payments that were past due, but every payment that would ever be due under the note, then you have basically a unified note encompassing the entire debt due under the note. And that's how those future payments come to be due at present and are litigated in the first action. And as I pointed out, there is no question in the first action that the plaintiff was seeking a judgment for the entire amount due and the sale of the house to satisfy that judgment. That's
race,
how foreclosure
race
works.
Race judicata requires, though, and this is following up on Justice Ann Bradley's question, race judicata requires, and I'm not going to get this exactly right, I'm going to paraphrase, that the controversy is capable of resolution at the time of the litigation. And that's why I said to Justice Ann Bradley that I wanted to ask that question, too. It's certainly at the forefront, I think, of all of our minds, as it is the parties. So here we have, okay, they lost on their first litigation. They lost because they were trying to enforce a note based on past missed payments. They lost. There's a discussion. You were right about paragraph 24, by the way. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And so the payments are not yet due. I didn't understand your answer, quite frankly. How are few payments that are not due at the time of the litigation, how are they capable of resolution at the time of the litigation, which you now, on behalf of your client, want to assert, serve to preclude the present action?
When a note is accelerated, as was the case in the first action,
but which Justice Kelly pointed out, there is nothing in the record to show. You said there's nothing in the record to show that there was an order to accelerate the note.
The claim in the first case was for the entirety of the debt. There's been no dispute about
based
this point.
Based on past missed payments, yes.
Correct, and that's the ordinary practice in foreclosures. Why would a lender who's foreclosing a mortgage only seek to foreclose a few payments?
You're very. I can tell you have a high degree of experience in this kind of thing. Banks don't want, contrary to the popular image, you know, it's been my experience. Banks foreclose as a last result. They don't want to wind up with a dead property, right? They want to work it out. So sometimes they have to foreclose in order to really get things moving. So there could be all sorts of reasons, as you know, there could be all sorts of reasons why they've got to just do it. There are certain, when the regulators come to town and they see the bank has been letting people get, not make their payments, banks can get in trouble too, especially post 2008. But anyways, so we can't assume that.
Well, this is one of the really interesting things about this case, which you've raised here, is that there were many things that could have been done along the way to avoid the outcome in the first action. A lender, when it's going to foreclose, the best practice is to carefully evaluate the loan documents and the lender's position.
Sure.
Presumably that happened in this case. It should certainly have happened at a point where it was clear that the case was going to be contested. And if there's a problem with the loan, most borrowers are quite eager to settle, and the parties can usually reach an agreement. That didn't happen in this case.
Right.
It seems like you're trying to have your cake and eat it, too, with respect to claim preclusion and acceleration. So for purposes of claim preclusion, you say the note was accelerated, but then you say they lost because they didn't make their case. Well, if they didn't make their case, part of their case was that it was accelerated, right?
That's not how claim preclusion would work, because if that's the case, the party could make a claim and then dial it back and say, well, I didn't prove this part of the claim, so I should get another chance to prove my claim now. I mean, think about the ramifications. We'd have all kinds of parties who took their case to trial, couldn't prove it, and then they would say, hey, well, we get another chance because we didn't prove this element of our claim.
Right, but part of what you're saying is the bank didn't have authority to enforce the loan, and part of the loan was accelerating it. So if it didn't have the authority to enforce it, it didn't have the authority to accelerate it either.
Under the first judgment, the plaintiff didn't have any right to deal with this note at all, failed to establish that right.
Right. So you are taking something that you argue never happened and using that as a basis for avoiding liability on the note, right?
I don't think so, and I'm not sure I understand
your
question.
The acceleration that did not happen is what he's talking about.
Exactly. You say acceleration never happened.
You're saying
there's nothing in the record that suggests that the note was accelerated, but now you are turned to claim preclusion, you say, and that's an adjudication that it was accelerated and they failed in their claim, and so I have no further obligation under the note. Is that right?
The claim was made that the note was accelerated. The claim was made for the entire debt due under the note in the first action. That's my point. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Thomas Dill, and I'm the attorney for Federal National Mortgage Association, which is my clients in here, and it's also known as Fannie Mae, as I think some of the justices has already pointed out. Your Honors, I have here in my hand the original note, paraphrasing the attorney for the plaintiff in the current lawsuit that's before the court today.
Counsel, what issue are you going to be addressing or issues?
Your
today?
Honor, I'm going to be addressing first the issue of whether or not the plaintiff was in possession of the original note at the time of the trial in this matter. And what transpired in the trial court action was the attorney for the one of the attorneys for the bank.
Counsel, could I suggest that we address claim preclusion first? If claim preclusion is effective, then there's no point in discussing whether you possessed the note at the time of the trial.
Well, there is a point, Your Honor. The court could make more clear the law on the issue of the UCC and possession of the original note and enforceability. But in answer to the court's questions, I would first like to state that in the pleadings, the plaintiff did state that there was a problem with the third prong of the issue preclusion test. And yes, we agree that there are three prongs to it. And we did agree that there was privity of, or the, there was the identity between the parties or the privies. The second step was the identity between the causes of action, which we do not agree occurred here. And thirdly, that there was a final judgment on the merits. I believe Mr. Strobel indicated that we weren't contesting the third element, and that is not true.
Does the certification indicate the Court of Appeals' understanding that you are contesting the third element? I read the certification, and my recollection, but it may be faulty because I read it a couple of days ago, is that the Court of Appeals certification indicated that the only issue in dispute vis-a-vis claim preclusion analysis was the identity of claim. Correct me if I'm wrong. What did the Court of Appeals certification say in that regard?
Justice Bradley, I believe you are correct that they didn't identify that. I don't know that we ever conceded the third element of issue preclusion. We certainly did not concede it in our briefing. But even with that, we do believe that even under the Northern States case and certainly under the Menard versus Lightway, that there is a requirement or there is a provision for the material operative facts. And part of that is also the issue of the distance of time. So the material operative facts in this case is in the first foreclosure action, the foreclosure encompassed a default through April 1st of 2009.
Right. And questions from the bench have revealed that we're aware of that. But one question I have for you that runs to the underpinnings, the reasons behind the ancient doctrine of res judicata, claim preclusion. And as I recall, again, I'm paraphrasing, there are at least two. The first is judicial economy, that if a court can hear a matter once, we want the court to hear it once. We don't want the precious resources of our circuit courts to be squandered by hearing matters serially, which could just be resolved in one case. And another underpinning of it is to not subject litigants to serial litigation. We all recognize that litigation is expensive and it's stressful, and it is typically one of the three most important things going on in the litigant's life at the time. So here's a large financial institution with pretty significant resources. Proving up a note is not the world's most complex fact to prove up. Now, it might be a little difficult to find in the vast, you know, after all the bundling and all the selling off of paper that went on when banks were encouraged in the form of bonuses given based on the number of loans written, sometimes to grossly unqualified applicants. But bonuses were given to employees. Wells Fargo took out a full-page ad not too long ago in various nationwide newspapers as a result of a court order apologizing. And it seems to me, you know, the bank typically has the upper hand in, you know, I presided for 6 years in a rural county where people, by and large, did not have a lot of money. I presided over my share of foreclosure actions. Proving up a note shouldn't be that difficult of a task. So I guess my question is, when they file the paperwork the first time, why shouldn't we expect that the bank, that the financial institution, is going to come to court with the essential document that proves they're entitled to the relief? And when they don't, why should the homeowner then be subject to serial litigation because the bank, we forgot the note, and no big deal, we'll just file again, and that guy can come back to court over and over again until we manage to get it right and find the right file. Why is that what issue preclusion was not designed to prevent? Claim preclusion. I said issue. I meant claim. Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor. The certainly to preface your earlier comments about the stress and all the other factors that go into a foreclosure action. But there's a second side of it, and as happened here is, and by Mr. Strobel's comments, Mr. Thompson has not made any payments since 2009.
That's nice, but the bank holds all the cards in the foreclosure action. Did you make the payment? I've presided over my share where the litigant, where the homeowner is unrepresented. They take the stand, and under the rules for unrepresented people, sometimes the judge has to do a little bit of helping out to flush out their side. Did you make the payments? No. But then they want to tell you why. And then you have to gently but firmly explain why that's not why we're here. So let's stick to the point. Let's stick to the point that I'm asking, not the one that you want to make. Why shouldn't we expect large financial institutions who have in the relationship all the resources, all the power, and all the time to get their ducks in a row? You held up that note. Bring the note. Here it is, Judge. Here's the note. Here are computer records showing he missed 6 months of payments. Please grant our foreclosure action. Why should we let banks have unlimited, under your theory, at the second litigation, what happens then if you didn't bring the wet ink copy, which I assume that's why you wanted to run to the UCC self-authenticating, because it's a wet ink copy self-authenticating. So what happens if you didn't, or if the bank, the financial institution, didn't bring it at the second one? Then a third time, a fourth time, until, okay, however many times it takes for the bank to get their act together. Why is that fair? Why is that a proper application of claim preclusion?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that it's going to come down to part of it, whether or not there are material operative facts that distinguish.
I'm sorry, what?
Material operative facts.
Which would be the note.
That would be the note, the default, the amount of the default, and the time difference between the first default and the second default.
And that is why you want to say it's not the same claim, right? Because of the time difference of the defaults. We've already fleshed that out. You were here, right? We've hammered him pretty hard on that, and he didn't have much of a response. He's doing the best he can with what he's got to work with, and he didn't really have, because there is not much of a response to that. But I'm asking you, how is it proper? Where do we draw the line? At the second bite at the apple for the bank? At the third? At the fourth? At what point do we say, enough, bank, bring the note when you bring the litigation?
Opposing counsel had submitted in its brief a Singleton case. And this Singleton case is an out-of-state case from Florida, from the Florida Supreme Court. And while we did not cite the case, it was cited by Attorney Strobel. And I think it's instructive in a couple of ways, because it talks about the equities of a foreclosure action. And
foreclosure actions are equitable actions.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct. And it talks about that and the unfairness of prohibiting the lender from bringing a second action when the default continues. And I think going earlier to Justice Kelly's questions regarding whether or not the loan was accelerated. Well, there was a request for acceleration, but the circuit court found that the evidence of acceleration was insufficient. So the note wasn't accelerated. So I think that's a key piece here.
I agree with you. That is a very...
Did the circuit court really find there wasn't evidence of acceleration, or did the circuit court simply conclude they hadn't presented the original note, so that was the end of their claim?
Well, the full decision dismissing the foreclosure complaint states the court finds that the plaintiff did not have sufficient evidence and or witnesses to proceed and dismisses the case with prejudice.
Right.
This is the final order. And as part of it, as part of what the circuit court was doing was looking at the evidence that was presented by the plaintiff in that action, which was BAC Home Loans, and found that the evidence that it tried to submit for, and there are really only a handful of things that you need to prove in a foreclosure action, and one of them is that you own the loan, that you have the right to enforce it.
You have the note.
Yes.
Right, you have the note. But I thought that's where the matter fell apart.
No, that's not where it fell apart. The court simply did not find the witness credible and did not find the witness for the plaintiff, the court did not find credible.
Well, what did he testify? Was she testified
that's right.
to?
That's all new evidence.
We call it the affidavit of indebtedness or the lender's affidavit.
Right.
And in that, and the witness did testify to this information live. But basically, it states, among other things,
testified that there was a note, that they had what seen the note, that that this was the amount due under the note, and they didn't do it from necessarily personal accounting of all of this, but on the basis of the records of the bank. Isn't that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. They're looking at the records that they have in their system, and the records in their system include the acceleration or the demand letter that is sent to all borrowers to get things started. You hereby owe X number of dollars, you have 30 days to pay it, etc. So the circuit court in this matter totally dismissed all of the evidence and didn't find the witnesses being credible. And that's why there is no adjudication as to the validity of the note, the validity of the mortgage, and the acceleration itself.
At that first trial, copies of the note were available, right?
Yes.
But the court decided that 91003, for example, wasn't adequate to allow in the copies. What was the basis for the court not allowing copies of the note? It isn't infrequent that copies rather than the original are available at a foreclosure action. So that's a little bit of a stumbling block for me. I know we're past that case now, but
There was a prior case. It was Dell Family versus PHH Corporation that basically said that you can't authenticate a photocopy of the note. So I don't know if the circuit court referred to that case or not, but that was a stumbling block. I think they accepted the accuracy of the note and all the other functions of it, but
and
the fact
the
that
court wouldn't allow them to supplement the record, right?
It was not allowed to supplement the record.
So instead of deciding it on the merits, the court said, we have a photocopy, I'm not going to let you bring in the original, I'm just going to say you haven't proved your case today, and dismissed it.
I don't know that the court actually said that you can't bring in the note, but obviously the original was not.
Well, didn't they make a motion for a continuance to allow their witnesses to
yes.
present additional
yeah, I'm sorry,
evidence
yes.
and support the foreclosure, and then the court said no and dismissed it, even though a copy of the note was sitting there?
Correct. The other thing that I find a little bit disheartening is that there is no affirmative pleadings on behalf of Mr. Thompson that states that is not my signature on the note.
Right.
I never signed a note.
That's why I'm interested in what, and I, you know,
the pleadings
aren't here.
They're not in the file. I had my law clerk look for them when I was reading this. They should be in the file.
I hate to revisit the original lawsuit, but when you have an opportunity to dispense of something on the merits, you would think that someone might want
to actually do that. So I'm trying to figure out why this case proceeded the way it did instead of just saying, oh, I have a photocopy. And the other, typically there's some sort of defense. It's not the original. They need to prove it. It's not my signature. It's been altered. Something that gives the other side a heads up. You need to prove this up. I mean, it'd be nice if they always brought it, but strange things happen in trial courts. I was there for a long time.
Right, and that's why, you know, I started to lead off with the possession of the note issue is because having done this for a number of years, it is not. Every time I go into a motion for summary judgment, I have the original note with me, and I want the court to see it. I want opposing counsel to see it, although they could have asked for it in discovery and never did. They never objected to the photocopy that is attached to the summons and complaint saying, I didn't sign that. They don't do that. And now we're left at the 11th hour in the trial where, the attorney for Mr. Thompson at that time said, well, gee, that was 12 years ago. I don't remember if it looked like that when I signed it, or I don't know if I'm looking at an original. He has the affirmative obligation to say that that's not my signature, that's not the original. He did not do that. And in the case of
isn't it correct, or let me ask, is it correct what the Court of Appeals says in their certification, that one of the reasons that the circuit court dismissed it is because there was failure of evidence to present the notice of intent to accelerate. Is that correct, or is the Court of Appeals wrong in its certification when it says that?
I'm not going to say that they're wrong.
Okay.
I am going to say that that is one of the reasons, okay. And if that's the primary reason for their certification, then we go back to this.
No, that isn't the primary reason for the certification. They say on page 2, the court, referring to the first circuit court here, concluded that BAC failed to present evidence of the original notice of intent to accelerate, evidence of the original note, and evidence that BAC was in possession of the original note. My question focuses on the first of those three. You've been listening to questions that focus on the second and third. I just want to know if the first, as pointed out by the Court of Appeals, is correct. That was a basis for the circuit court's determination that there wasn't sufficient evidence.
Yes. Yes, I believe that's true. I believe it's consistent with the order of Judge Burtz in the Circuit
but
Court.
But, counsel, it's consistent, but what this is calling to mind is something that's been rubbing me the wrong way from the get-go. It seems to me the Circuit Court prefaced its remarks in, I don't know what it was, a dismissal by using unorthodox language, at least in my experience, by sort of trying to walk the line of saying, well, I'm not making a ruling on, this is my interpretation, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not making a judgment on the merits. It just so happens that when the bank came here today, it didn't have the right materials. But that's in stark contrast, if I'm reading it right, it almost seems like a non sequitur when the circuit court threw in at the end a dismissal with prejudice, which, as we've already talked about, whether the phrase with prejudice has a place in this context is up for debate. But I'm trying to figure out, do you understand what I'm referring to? And it runs to the dismissal on the merits as opposed to, well, I'm not going to grant your motion for a continuance, but if you want to bring it again, go ahead. But then that's what the first part that Justice Ann Bradley was reading from, to my mind, goes to the signal to go ahead and bring it again. But then at the very end, slam the door shut with prejudice. Did that strike you as unorthodox? And if so, how do you resolve it? Or am I just barking up the wrong tree?
I don't believe you're barking up the wrong tree. It is unorthodox. As many of you know, judges have different personalities and different ways of viewing the law. Beyond that, I don't know that I can comment too much further.
All right.
Well, let me see if I can help you.
The Court of Appeals say it was forfeited?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Didn't the Court of Appeals say that issue was forfeited because it wasn't raised?
I don't know if the Court of Appeals specifically said that.
They did.
They
said you can't challenge this, that she should not have made it with prejudice in a civil action.
Right, but we didn't raise
it. Because they hadn't done it originally.
Right.
They get to the appellate court, they start on an issue that they didn't raise earlier. And the general rule is the court doesn't have to address it. Now, sometimes the court uses the word forfeit. Sometimes they use the word waive, and sometimes they use neither of those words and just talk about the appellate court won't address it because it wasn't raised below. So was this raised?
No, it wasn't raised, Your Honor.
Was it the same circuit court judge who permitted this matter to go forward as granted the dismissal with prejudice? Was it Judge Burtz for both cases?
No, it was not.
Who was the second judge?
Judge Amy Smith.
Say it again?
Judge Smith.
Yes. Smith, thank you.
Dane County.
They both are Dane County.
Would just like to mention one thing that I believe it was you, Justice Roggensack, had mentioned that the note hasn't gone away. That wasn't really adjudicated. The mortgage hasn't gone away. That definitely was not adjudicated. There's a statute of limitations on mortgages for 30 years. Now, that being said, there's oftentimes we'll be presented with a situation where the note has not been collected on for more than 6 years. Under 893.43, there's a six-year statute of limitations. Notes are considered contracts in that event. And then we can't foreclose on the note and get a money judgment, but we can foreclose on the mortgage. And it's not different than what happens in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, for instance, where we can't get a money judgment on the note, but we can foreclose on the mortgage.
I wonder why you wouldn't argue then, as we've already established, you and I, at least two out of two of us agree that, and it is pretty well established, that mortgage actions related to mortgage are equitable in nature. That, and you're not making the argument here, I'm not aware that you've made the argument anywhere, that, gee, judge or court, it just isn't fair that, well, that's equity.
My law school civics professor would roll his eyes every time a student said, professor, it's not fair. So
the famous thing I heard my first year in law school, and I never used the phrase since, I wasn't the one who said it, some other unfortunate soul. And the law school professor's response was, the fair is in August. That. But in equity, they've carved out, we have carved out through tradition and statute, certain areas of the law that are equitable. And mortgage foreclosure actions are one of those areas where fairness is a lawful consideration. So I'm just curious. I don't know the answer to the question.
Well, yes, we did agree that foreclosures are equitable in nature, and there really should be equity in the foreclosure trial process itself and the outcome. Now, the bank isn't entitled in this case to a money judgment from Mr. Thompson anyway. It waived its right of deficiency, so there's no money judgment being sought, but it is entitled to foreclose on the real estate and bid at the sheriff's sale and possibly take title back to the property, or whatever the bid is at the sheriff's sale. That is one of its options. The other option is Mr. Thompson hasn't paid on the property since 2009. I suspect that he hasn't paid for the taxes or for the insurance, because the banks typically do that because they don't want the properties lost to a tax sale. They also don't want it to burn down and have nothing of any collateral left over. So a free house is certainly not stretching the circumstances in this case. 2009, no principal and interest, no tax and insurance escrow is being made. So I know Fannie Mae, it's considered a GSE or a government-sponsored entity, and it's big, but it's also keeping the wheels of the mortgage industry alive. It buys back loans so the small mom-and-pop bank can get that money back to make other loans, and that's one of the strengths of the mortgage lending industry in this country. So it's not necessarily poor Fannie Mae, but now it doesn't have its house. It doesn't have its monthly payments, and it doesn't have the collateral. So is that for? I know it's unfortunate for Mr. Thompson to go through numerous proceedings, but I think that's a small price to pay.
Your argument does come down then to what the questions from the bench were mainly to your opposing counsel, which is, gee, what about the payments that had not yet become due at the time of the first action? So therefore, there is not an identity of claims. That really is the crux, the nut of your argument.
You are correct, Your Honor.
But I understood you to be claiming in your complaint or amended complaint for the payments that were the subject of the first action, which had been dismissed with prejudice. Is my understanding correct? In other words, you were covering that time period.
In the initial action, we went back to the default to April 1st of 2009. In the second action, we are looking at payments in default to, I believe, September 1st of 2009.
So you were not looking for any default that encompassed the first action. Is that correct? I guess I thought you were in your complaint.
Your Honor, I believe you are correct. The complaint did that, and I think under issue preclusion, they should have been forestalled from being able to claim that.
Contrary to what your complaint and amended complaint indicate, you are no longer here today asking for payments for that time period that was covered by the first action. Is that your position?
I think we'd like to take a two-faced response to that. And the first is, if this is governed by issue preclusion, that would be correct, Your Honor, that we shouldn't be entitled to the first because that was lost, but we should be entitled to the second. However, if there was no acceleration, if there was no adjudication on the merits as to the validity of the note and mortgage, I think we are entitled to go all the way back for all the payments that were due and payable. But I would also mention again to the court that we waived our right to a deficiency. There is no money judgment being sought for this. But we do have to prove that what the debt was under Chapter 846 anyway. So that's why we still have to make the proof of what the amount of the indebtedness is.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you all. Thank you.
Counsel, your client is not going to be asked to pay a dollar. He hasn't paid a dollar of payments on the house in which he lives since 2009. Why are you here before us? Does he want to keep the property and have the mortgage vacated? Why are you here?
Claim preclusion doesn't address these kinds of questions.
No,
of
I don't care
the
about
outcome.
That. I'm asking you a straightforward question. Why are you here? What is your client seeking?
My client, Mr. Thompson, wants to keep his home.
Okay, so he wants to have a judgment that's going to essentially vacate
the mortgage, correct? Even though he's not paid a dollar, because no one's asking him for money today.
Correct. Well, we'll have to cross that bridge when we come to it. I honestly
can't
say.
Well, I think you're at the bridge right now.
I honestly can't say what is going to happen after this court makes the decision. If this court decides in Mr. Thompson's favor, we're going to have to sort this out with the bank, because there's still a mortgage out there.
I know, and that's what's causing me a lot of difficulty in understanding why you bring this claim all the way up here to the Supreme Court when your client hasn't paid a dollar for the house in which he lives since 2009. I wish I could say that, okay? And the bank is not asking him for money today. But you're not asking this court to vacate the mortgage. So I'm not sure what in the heck we're doing here.
Well, we're getting into
the
question.
To be comprehensive, it doesn't sound to me, and I agree, I have the same question.
Yeah, right.
But it sounds to me like maybe the bank did not articulate that particular concession until the question had been asked. And it took me by surprise.
I think in the pleadings they waive a deficiency, right?
You waive it?
Yeah.
Let me start with the record.
You're willing. I'm sorry. Yes. Okay. So they're willing. The bank is willing to start from now. So the Chief Justice is right. Your client doesn't have to pay anything.
Correct. That would be not to this lender. This lender does not have entitlement to enforce a note that was established in the first action. And let me talk about the record in the first action. I want to direct the court's attention to appellate's appendix, pages 11 to 12.
Before you do that, counsel, I want to make sure we do have an answer to the Chief Justice's question, which is, what are you doing here? And I think the answer to that is part of what you said. Mr. Thompson wants to keep his house, but he also wants to make no payments on it, correct?
Right. That's correct.
The second part, I'm sorry, I didn't
right.
hear.
So, Mr. Thompson, the reason you're here today is because Mr. Thompson wants to keep his house, but he also wants to make no payments on it, correct?
That's what was decided in the first action, that this
counsel, please. I'm not asking what was decided in the first action. The Chief Justice asked you why you're here, and I want to make sure we get an answer to that. So the reason we're here is because Mr. Thompson wants to keep his house and make no payments on it, correct?
Make no payments to this plaintiff.
Okay. Who does he want to make payments to?
No one has stepped forward to demand payments from Mr. Thompson. And
except for Fannie Mae.
I'm sorry?
Except for Fannie Mae.
Correct. And they're a privity of BAC, which failed to prove entitlement to enforce this note in the first action.
So your position today is that Mr. Thompson owes no one anything on the note that he promised he would repay.
Our position isn't that Mr. Thompson doesn't owe anything in the note. I believe the note cannot be enforced as a result of the first judgment.
Does the record show, and if it's not in the record, don't tell me, does the record show in dollar values how much that concession from the bank is worth?
I believe, this is off the top of my head, I mean, I can point to the complaint in the first action, which is in the record. It's record 10. That's the
but
document.
I assume that the number has the number's gone up since then. But if, right, the number's gone up, he hasn't made any payments. But if that's not in the record, I'll take at least whatever the freshest information in the record is, even though we're all kind of curious, but we have to limit ourselves to what's in the record.
The answer is in the record at item number 10. And so my point of pointing out the record. Yes?
How much? What's the answer?
Let's take a look.
About. You don't have to give me the exact. I can look it up. Never mind. You only have a few minutes. I can look it up if it's enough.
The first complaint was for $153,000. The second complaint
seems $200,000 and change. You can go on with your argument.
$152,000. Page 1.
In fact, doesn't the first complaint and the second amended complaint have the same amount of money or the judgment, and that is $152,355.98?
Right.
And how can they be the same given the passage of time? I see your time is up, but It seems odd to me that given the passage of time and the payments that were missed, that they can be the same. I guess I'll have to divine that answer. Yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
We divine.
Thank you very much.
We divine.
Well, thank you, counsel. This is really a head-scratcher, frankly, this case. So.
And I very rarely, I think this is only the second time that I've chimed in. I've enjoyed and appreciated both of your arguments.
Yeah, and your briefs were well done. I will go and look and see if I can find the original complaint, because I had my law clerk look for it, the one in the first action, not this one, which I read. Okay. It was not what I saw when I looked through that. But thank you very, very much. We enjoyed the arguments quite a lot.